Labor Day is a salute and a celebration of the American worker, an endless, eternal reminder of the people who built this country, who laid the track, who carved out the mountains, who built the cities, the broad shoulders upon which American industry was built. It is to honor the memories of those people who worked hard for an unfair day's pay, who died poisoned by an environment that was toxic, who died in mine shafts, who died of cancer, but they didn't know it was cancer, so every wasting disease was consumption in the 19th century. They worked hard, they died mostly poor and mostly young, and they were horrendously exploited. And Labor Day is our eternal reminder of the sacrifice that they made. It's a reminder also of the sacrifice that was made by the people who tried to organize workers, who tried to get a truly fair day's pay for a fair day's work, who wanted the mines cleaned up, who wanted air to breathe, who wanted people not to die young and poor in factories and in sweatshops, in mines and on bridges and building girders and in smelly, hot, miserable factories. And Labor Day is to honor all of them. And as a nation, what I have just said makes sense to almost no one in our country, because we have forgotten all of that. We honor labor, but we honor labor in the abstract. We honor labor sentimentally. We have a romance of labor, but it is like a summer romance. It is fleeting, a thing where the sun starts shining again and we wake from this dream of a romance of labor and we go, oh no, because labor is not honored in this country. It's probably not honored in many countries, but in this country, I think in particular. It's interesting and I suspect ironic that when we look at the class system in England, we can see so clearly how they viewed class as something that there were just things that gentlemen didn't do, like work, and that people were born into a certain class and they could do as well as they could, but even if they got money, you didn't really move from your origins very far. We see that so clearly when we take the time to look at the Indian caste system and see the inherent unfairness of being trapped by birth into a destiny on this earth that is privileged or radically unprivileged and exploited. And as the Bible says, we are very good at seeing the mote in the eyes of other societies and not the logs in our own. Probably because the logs in our eyes block our vision. And we don't see how clearly we really do not respect labor. Labor is something, manual labor particularly, and brace yourself, this is not my ethnic slur, is for people named Manuel. I am saying this, and it is offensive, and it is an offensive truth in the racism of this nation that associates people with certain skin color to certain jobs and would, at least culturally, if not legally, restrict the integration of what we consider to be the good professions, the honorable professions, the high status professions. In our society, we make assumptions about people by race, by ethnicity. And everybody is complicit in terms of not our racism necessarily, but our classism. Because we identify ourselves by class. We identify ourselves by class of where we live, how we live, what our ecological footprint is, what kind of car or SUV or truck or van we drive. I can drive into a parking lot and make a pretty good guess about the educational level, maybe not the income, but the educational level of the people by the cars that they are driving. Because almost as much as old Europe, we identify ourselves by our class. And class is not exactly equivalent to income. It is inexact in this society. So that a black basketball player who is far wealthier than anyone in this room is still not of the same class. And these judgments are made from how people were born, how people dress, what people drive, and what the content of their melanin is as opposed to the content of their character. We value in our society clean hands and clean fingernails more than clean character. And that's kind of crazy, isn't it? I had a dream last night, and I swear to you that this is true because I've got 1,600 pages of manuscript and this isn't in it. 1,600 words. Did I say 1,600 pages? No. It was a long sermon, but not as long as Danzig's. It's a much shorter sermon now. It was 1,600 pages. Now it's 1,600 words. And my dream wasn't in it. I had a dream that I came to church and I was dressed in shorts and a shirt. I was decent. I was presentable. But it felt wrong. This was not the you're standing there naked dream. I've never had the standing there naked dream. No, I've never had stage fright. So that's what the standing there naked dream is about. But I had apparently the inappropriate dress anxiety. I guess any dress would be inappropriate. Well, anyway. I remember during this dream it became a nightmare that I'm sitting there going, why don't I have a suit and a jacket and a tie in the car? Can I borrow one? Maybe I can borrow a jacket. Where's Dick Cole when I need him? Anybody here wearing a tie? No. Can't borrow a tie. We dress in uniforms. We dress in uniforms by occupation, by class, by taste, by affinity. We want to belong. We show off and who we are by how we dress and how we get the memo. And I'm not sure how people get the memo, but I know that if I walk in dressy casual here, I'm not feeling that it's quite right. But if I wear a suit and a tie on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, no one will talk to me. They'll think I'm a working stiff. I should take the tie off and put on some sandals, and I can wear jeans, but not just any jeans. You've got to get the class memo on what jeans you are allowed to wear to show where you really and truly belong. We are a festival of cultural anthropology, and fortunately, we have an expert here in that, so the talk back should be fun. It's so arbitrary, like the idea of race and ethnicity. It's so completely arbitrary. Do you know that up until the end of the 19th century, wealthy people stayed out of the sun and went for as light a complexion as they could possibly have, because they didn't want to get tanned like those workers out there in the field. And then, when the workers in the field became the workers in the factories and in the shops became derisively ribbon clerks, the wealthy wanted not to be identified with those pallid people, but the leisurely class that could sit outside and get a tan. There's nothing a priori. Status, high status or low status, about pale and tan, except that fashion makes it so. There are societies where men on the right finger grow a long fingernail to show that they don't do manual labor. There is this intense conflict that people have about what it is that we do. Do you earn your money with your hands or with your mind? Is it vaporware, or are you building something solid? And we as a society are in the middle of a great transition. It started in the industrial age, and the outcome of it is obvious, but the date of the outcome is less obvious. Ever since John Henry won the race and lost the war and died with a hammer in his hand, great God, died with his hammer in his hand, the industrial might beats the physical might. That game is over. But there are still cultural conflicts between, and I love this because of the mixed metaphor, pointy-headed intellectuals and eggheads. You can't have it both ways. They're two different shapes. I mean, you can't, can you? Well, I guess in politics you can, in racism you can, in any kind of emotional conflict, you can have it both ways because it doesn't have to make sense. In America, most people believe that we are in the middle class. From below the poverty line to over $500,000 a year, people self-identify as in the middle class. That means that the people who are truly poor, we can't do anything about them because they just want to be that way. And we want to be with the truly rich. We identify with the truly rich. Somebody who has a couple of shares of stock is a capitalist. All you have to do is have, from your Starbucks employment, a little bit of stock sharing at the end of the year, and you have become part of the capitalist class. We have forgotten what the struggle in life is about. That these unions were formed because unregulated, unbridled capitalism did not lead to capitalism, to competition, to real markets, but to false markets. False markets for goods and false markets for the services of the people who created the goods. And it is less important whether you work with your hands or whether you work with your head or how, whether you do services or goods, then there is a sense of oneness, a sense that we are in relationships as people together. The meaning of Labor Day, I think, has been largely forgotten because people thought the battle was won and everyone was in the middle class. But as you look at the rhetoric and as you look at the policies of the last two administrations, you will see that antitrust laws have meant nothing, Republican and Democrat alike. You will see that the unions have been demonized, and workers and unions have gone from underdogs to fat cats in the minds of most of the public. And what happens is that you get the equivalent of the old welfare queen story, so that in today's newspaper, we find out that the average salary of a longshoreman is $90,000. And the average salary of a teacher is. We think that status is inherent. It's not. It's not inherent at all. When I was young and impressionable, I remember my good communist relatives talking about over half of the doctors in the Soviet Union were women. And I thought, wow, that's terrific, until I went to the Soviet Union and found out they were paid less than bus drivers. Doctors went from high status to, in the Soviet Union, low status, and here, quite honestly, from high status to middle level. Teachers went from a good job for a woman to a nice career increasingly to a job. Our society is moving, and the unions need to be very aware of it, and people need to be very aware of it, from a place where people had careers to jobs, which is different from careers, to just projects. That you are hired to do a project, part-time, without benefits, and with the benefits being paid then in some maniacal way, partially by the state. We have worked ourselves into a crazy situation where we demean the idea of work, almost like the English aristocracy trying to stay indoors to stay pallid until too many people got pallid and then went outdoors. It's a crazy situation, and it's a situation that needs not the sentimentalizing of labor, but an understanding of the value that each part of our society contributes to the whole. Whether it is the people who are imported here to pick our crops, to raise our children, to clean our homes, but not to have driver's licenses, whether it is the people who build our cars, who service our industries, who interface with us every day, but we don't see them because all of us have locked ourselves away in our own safe little self-categorized boxes and don't see that when we are put into all of these different categories, we have no power. We have no power until we make true the opening paragraph of this talk. And that is to honor and to remember and, as the anthem said, to pass on the story of the oneness that is the goal of a decent society. To treat people well. To look into the eyes of the stranger, the eyes of the server, the eyes of the people that we deal with every day and see them as common creatures bound on the same journey to the same destination and not strangers with other fates. Whatever their faiths are, whatever their politics are, we share a common fate. And we need to understand that, to celebrate it, and to pass it on. Because all of the gains that were made at the end of the 19th century to just balance the equities will be lost unless we fight for balance. Not victory of one over the other, but a sense of fairness and the dynamic tension that a real society needs to have in order to stay decent. Yes, every movement you can find the people who use it and exploit it. But most human beings, if given a chance, are decent, and most demands, if honored, lead to a more decent, more goodly society. And we have a part. We have a part when we remember the truth, not just the sentiment. When we tell the stories, not just the myths. And we can use the myths, the John Henrys, to generate conversations about change, about flexibility, about how John Henry needed to learn how to operate that damn machine. But we have a part. We are not spectators in our own society. And we begin by remembering our truths.